Thank you, Sue. I'll start with agenda paper 5. The committee received a request about whether an entity includes demand deposits with restrictions on use as a component of cash and cash equivalents in the statements of cash flows and financial position. Paragraphs 8 to 18 summarize the outreach performed, and paragraphs 11, 19 to 40 include our analysis of the matter. Based on our analysis, we conclude that applying the requirements in IAS 7 and IAS 1, the entity A includes the demand deposit with restrictions on use as a component of cash and cash equivalents in its statement of cash flows, and B presents it as cash and cash equivalents in its statement of financial position, unless presenting it separately in an additional line item is relevant to an understanding of the entity's financial position. Furthermore, paragraphs 45 and 48 of IAS 7 include disclosure requirements on the components of cash and cash equivalents and the amount of significant cash and cash equivalent balances that are not available for use by the group. The entity would also consider whether to disclose additional information in the context of the requirements in IFRS 7 about liquidity risk and how the entity manages that risk. I will now direct you to question 1 on page 9 and ask whether you agree with our analysis regarding the application of the requirements in IFRS standards.
Thank you very much, Stefano. So, who would like to comment on the analysis in the paper? Donna.
All right. First of all, I'd like to compliment the staff on a very well-written paper. I thought it was well thought out. It presented the arguments exceptionally succinctly. With respect to the paper in general, I am in agreement with the staff's view that the few principles that have been clarified in the paper. One, that IS1 doesn't define whether an item is cash or cash equivalent. Rather, IS1 defines whether it can be current or non-current. And I definitely agree with that, which you detailed in paragraph 24B. With respect to paragraph 25, I do agree with your view that the restriction of the use of an item doesn't preclude the item from being cash and cash equivalent, as long as that restriction doesn't change the nature. And I think that's very, very important. And then obviously the what's in paragraph 26 with respect to the contractual obligations restricts only the purpose for which the entity can use that asset. In particular, I agreed with the sentiment that was expressed in paragraph 26. So with regards to the questions that you've asked, I'm in agreement with the analysis. And as such, nothing else that I can really add to the discussion other than the fact that I think it really does put it up very nicely and makes very clear how IS1 and IS7 actually interact with each other with regards to identifying whether an item is cash and cash equivalent, lives within 7, and whether you classify it as long or short term. And even if you can, in actual fact, have cash and cash equivalent, that could be considered to be a non-current asset. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Carsten.
Yes, thanks. So I think overall the staff have done a great job in focusing on the relevant points with regards to the question that was asked. I think the logic in the paper is really convincing. So in relation to the staff analysis on the current requirements and applicable IFRS standards, I fully agree with the staff analysis and conclusions, and I'm supportive of the tentative agenda decision. I do have one drafting suggestion in relation to the wording, but I guess we come back to that later. I'd like to make a comment, though, around whether current IFRS requirements in this area lead to decision-useful information for stakeholders in these types of fact patterns, especially when an entity has solvency or liquidity issues. I think there may be a question here about whether decision-useful information is provided to users when presenting restricted cash that may not be available to the entity for extended periods of time within cash and cash equivalents, and whether it might make sense to more closely align the definition of cash and the definition of cash equivalents. So I wonder whether a close alignment of those definitions may be an area worth considering by the board for potential standard setting at some stage. Of course, I realize that this would require resources and acknowledge that this needs to be prioritized with other potential projects. But it seems this is a good time to think about it, given the currently ongoing agenda consultation. Rather than narrow scope standard setting, you know, I even wonder whether potentially this could be considered as part of a larger project that might include a broader consideration of the requirements in IS 7. seems there's been an increasing number of questions that come up that have come up in relation to the statement of cash flows recently. And the cash flow statement clearly is an area of focus for investors and other stakeholders. My sense is that these questions include not just where to present cash flows in the statement of cash flows, but also a number of questions around, you know, when something meets the definition of cash and cash equivalents, and even questions around when a cash flow exists for an entity. For example, the latter issue came up when we discussed presentation of reverse factoring in the statement of cash flows, where it was noted that IAS 7 contains no requirements of when a cash flow exists for an entity. Also, there are many questions around where to present cash flows in the statement of cash flows. So IAS 7 is quite an old standard, and given the cash flow statement clearly is an area of focus for investors in particular, I think it might be helpful having this in mind when considering and analyzing the feedback on the currently ongoing agenda consultation. That's it from my side. I guess we come to the proposed wording of the tentative agenda decision later on. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carsten. Sounds like you should send us a letter on the agenda consultation.
We will.
Okay, Jens.
Thank you, Sue. I will keep the feedback brief. I fully agree with the technical analysis and do think this paper and the tentative agenda decision helps clarifying an issue that we see a lot of times in practice where we see diversity, and therefore I'm fully supportive of releasing the tentative agenda decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Sophie.
So it is the same for me. I fully agree with the staff analysis. The paper is really very clear, and so I agree not to add a standard setting project on this topic. And also I have no comment on the wording of the tentative agenda decision.
Thank you, Sophie. Brian?
Thank you, Sue, and hello, everyone. I had a few observations about this. I think, firstly, I was looking at this fact pattern in paragraph 5, and I think it's very important that the analysis and the agenda decision are seen to specifically address the fact pattern in paragraph 5. And there what's going on is that you have a demand deposit, and then you have a separate agreement with the third party that imposes these contractual restrictions. And in that kind of, you know, there's no escrow account, there's no transfer of funds or anything like that. And in this very narrow and specific fact pattern, I think I would get to the same answer as the staff, which seems to be broadly supported by everyone who's spoken up to now. I guess my second point, though, is I'm a bit concerned about the possibility that you can have diversity in practice as soon as you start to move away from this very straightforward fact pattern. When we received the outreach request at KPMG, I heard reports from around the globe that there was some diversity. That seems to be acknowledged in paragraph 16 of the staff paper as well. There is, I think, a 2018 ESMA enforcement decision on a fairly similar fact pattern, not an identical fact pattern, but a similar one that seems to get to the opposite view. And as Carsten noted, when we had what I thought was a very useful discussion about supply chain financing last year, one of the constraints on that discussion acknowledged in the staff paper at the time is that there isn't really anything in IAS 7 that helps you identify what is and is not a cash flow for an entity. And perhaps you're going to tell me that I'm drifting into agenda consultation territory. But I do have a concern that there should be diversity on such a basic question as to whether or not an entity has some cash and whether it has a cash movement that should be in its cash flow statement. So I think for now, I know we'll talk about drafting of the agenda decision later. I guess I would support the agenda decision so long as it is absolutely as clear as it possibly can be that the agenda decision is just addressing the situation where you do have a demand deposit and a contractual restriction that arises in an entirely separate agreement with a third party, because I do have this concern about diversity of the identification of cash and cash flows in more complex fact patterns. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Karen.
Yeah, I agree with the conclusion in the paper and also echo that it was well laid out and clear to follow. I also have some drafting comments on the agenda decision, so I'll hold those till we get to that part of the call.
Thank you, Karen. Guy.
Thanks, Sue. I'll try not to repeat what some others have said, but I think my thoughts are rather similar to, I think, what Brian was just laying out. I generally would agree with the notion that the cash equivalence definition contains features that are not present in the definition of cash. And so I think the points made on that are clear, and I would agree with that. But focusing on the definition of cash, some of the points of pause I had on this issue were the demand deposit element of that cash definition and the sort of lack of detailed definition around what is or isn't a demand deposit. I think in the particular fact pattern we're assessing, the fact that that we have a demand deposit relationship between the entity and a bank, and then a separate contractual restriction is important to the analysis, and I think is core to the conclusion that we've reached on this particular set of facts. And I think in that circumstance, I can understand how we've concluded. It's like a restriction on cash on hand that doesn't impact the fact that I still have cash on hand. It meets the definition of cash, and so a separate restriction on the demand deposit arrangement between the entity and the bank seems correct to analyze that in a similar fashion. But in other circumstances where the restriction is not separate and is embedded in the demand deposit arrangement, I think there are legitimate questions that can arise there on whether that restriction could impact on the assessment of whether, in fact, it still is a demand deposit. But those questions seem to go beyond the particular fact pattern we've been presented with. But I think core to our conclusion here is this the separation between the two arrangements. And at the risk of delving into wording on the tentative agenda decision ahead of that question, I think it is important that we make that a little more clear in terms of the rationale for our conclusion in the agenda decision. So rather than simply saying, in the fact pattern described in the request, the restrictions on use of the amounts held in the demand deposit do not change the nature of the demand deposit, the entity can access those amounts on demand, it doesn't really focus on the reason as to why. And so I would think it would be quite helpful if somewhere in that sentence or perhaps elsewhere in the agenda decision, we could focus the reader's attention on the fact that there are separate arrangements here and the restriction is not part of the demand deposit arrangement between the entity and the bank. But maybe it's as simple as saying the separate restrictions on use of the amounts held in the demand deposit do not change the nature of the demand deposits. Maybe a quite a simple tweak to those words might help make that core fact to the conclusion, important to the conclusion, a little more clear in the agenda decision. So I'll stop there. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Guy. Goro? Goro, oh, are you with us?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Well, like others, I fully agree with the afternoon's decision analyzed sufficiently and properly every aspect of the issue around the submission. I support the staff's analysis and recommendation not to add a standard setting project and publish tentative agenda decision. And I also want to emphasize that the importance of disclosure on this matter. The demand deposit with restriction on you. Any restrictions on you?
Sorry, can you hear me? Not very well, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I would like to emphasize that on top of that, the presentation and a definition of cache and the presentation, I think that the disclosure aspect of this issue is also important. The demand deposit with list demand deposit without any restrictions on use. In that regard, disclosure of the relevant information on the liquidity risks around this demand deposit should be essential for the financial statement users to understand that the economic substance of this deposit. And in that regard, I have some questions over wording regarding wording in the agenda decision. Line on the blah blah blah. Can we use should instead of would? Because that I'm not a native English speaker, but I just feel that the would is somewhat weaker, and I think that the entity should always consider about the disclosure on the the risk profile, and also that they need to explain about the contracts.
Okay, I think we could tweak the words there to say.
Thank you.
Okay, on that very specific point, just while you raise it, I might have the opposite reaction to should versus would. However, mm-hmm. I think we could sidestep the issue by being more direct and just saying the entity considers and taking out the qualifier. Then it might be more direct. Mm-hmm. That might be a way of addressing your point. Thank you, Goro. I think the disclosures are very important given the restrictions. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
John, I think you were next.
Yes, thank you. So first, I echo the comments from Brian and Guy. I also had a comment on the disclosure, which I think was just addressed with the discussion with Goro. There is one aspect, though, on the analysis where I find myself pausing, and perhaps I'm being intentionally contrary here. But if I look at paragraph 24B, and which refers to paragraph 66D of IAS 1, and talks about that it requires an entity to classify as a current asset, cash or cash equivalents as defined in IAS 7, unless the asset is restricted from being exchanged or used to settle a liability for at least 12 months after the reporting date. In this instance, the cash is immediately available to settle a specified liability. It just so happens that the expected timing of that liability is the maturation of that liability is expected to go beyond 12 months. So I could envision a preparer or a technical analysis saying, look, the nature of the asset is that it is immediately available. It just so happens that it's earmarked contractually for a specified purpose. And that specified purpose is not expected to mature for more than 12 months. And I wondered if that was an aspect that the staff considered, because it builds off of earlier in the paper where it talks about the nature of the asset, and the nature of the asset as cash and a cash equivalent is not affected by the contractual relationship, the sale of the business. Here too, the fact that the cash and cash equivalent is, the immediacy of it being available to settle a liability is not affected, it just is specified to a specific liability. And the liability happens to be the matter, the item that has a duration that is greater than 12 months. So that's the one aspect I was struggling with, because and again, perhaps it comes across as a bit pedantic, but it is something that I think I could see someone arguing. And I wondered if it was something that was considered by the staff.
I had a reaction, but I don't know if anybody else wanted to.
Go ahead, soon we'll come in after.
Yeah, you're never going to get criticised for being pedantic by me, John. You're in safe hands on that front, but I can out-pedantic anybody. But on the way that I would have read, I've got some competition in this room for sure. Paragraph 66D, I might have read it that way. If you had a lot, if you could only use the cash to meet an obligation that was could only arise after 12 months, I might read this. But because I think the warranty could arise tomorrow, I wouldn't have read this paragraph as being on point personally. But I don't know whether.
Maybe I would just add, John, I think you're honing in on whether, I think in this particular fact pattern, yeah, we say it's cash, but would you end up classifying that as current or a non-current asset? To be honest, we simply haven't. That wasn't part of the question asked in the submission, and we have not analysed that in the paper. So when we've made reference to 66D, we've done it, I suppose, in two respects. We've done it, first of all, to say that 66D, as well as some requirements in IS 7, indicate at least, we think quite clearly, that you can classify something as cash and cash equivalents, even though there are some restrictions on its use. So it's simply evidence to us that there can be some restrictions and still classify something as cash. The second mention we have of it, of course, is just a note to say that in this situation, when the entity does, you know, conclude that this is cash and there are some restrictions in terms of how it presents that, you know, it'll need to think about that and just look at that in terms of, you know, whether it presents that cash as current or non-current. But we haven't analysed, so we're not reaching a conclusion in the paper at all in this case on whether you would present this as current or non-current. We were just noting those requirements as something that clearly are there and the entity would need to think about.
Okay, so I may have misinterpreted then paragraph 30. I thought paragraph 30 was suggesting that the entity would consider it as a non-current asset. So if that was not intended to be conclusionary, but more just to highlight that this is the thought process that a preparer and others would need to go through, I agree with that. If paragraph 30 was intended to lead to a conclusion, then I think that's where I have some reservation.
Yeah, no, at least our intention, and maybe we weren't as clear as we could be, as paragraph 30 was simply almost quoting that requirement to say you'd classify it as non-current, but only in the words of 6060 to the extent that it's restricted from being used. So we haven't done that assessment to say, is it restricted from being used for at least 12 months?
Okay, thank you.
So ignore me, that's the summary. Anyway, Tom?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think it was Brian who referenced to the WCS 22nd extract of the WCS database in which we published the decision with at least comparable fact pattern in which we said the disclosures are very important and in which case we came to another conclusion than the staff. Of course, we will reconsider at the moment the final agenda decision related to this issue will be approved and published. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Jim.
Thank you, Sue. And I think it's a well-written paper, and I do agree with the analysis and the conclusion. And I would like to have a minor suggestion here, thinking about the other parts of the world. Why I'm saying that is it seems that the term demand deposits is not an issue here among this group. We all understand and we treat it like a well-defined terminology. But in some other parts of the world, if the English-speaking environment is not well-developed, I could see the terminology possibly being misinterpreted or not and carried out well. They could very well use the term controlled or special-purposed or restricted deposits. I assume they're all just pointing toward the same kind of business arrangement here. So to make this paper more kind of broadly carried out. I would suggest that if we could somehow define the term demand deposit some way so that people all know that in this kind of arrangements, these kind of treatments should be the proper way. Just thinking some other people's possibility. Since demand deposits, this, I just want to give this terminology a better or well or clear definition.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Vijay?
Yeah, thanks. I agree with the staff analysis in para 19 to 39, except with reference to paragraph 30, which John mentioned a little while ago. While in the final agenda decision wording, we are not commenting on the non-current aspect or current aspect, except giving reference to para 66D of IAS-1. A plain reading of para 30 gives an impression. A plain reading of para 30 gives an impression that the staff is giving a conclusion that it is non-current in nature. That's the impression. I tried to read it again, but reading harmoniously the entire fact pattern and analysis, and given that it's almost the conclusion part of the presentation header, it gives an impression that staff is concluding it is non-current, whereas it actually is current in the fact pattern in my early reservation.
Yeah, thank you, Vijay. I'll just reiterate that I understand that maybe we didn't write that paragraph as clearly as we could have, but certainly our intention was only to sort of quote the requirement in a sense and not to suggest that we had reached a conclusion in this particular fact pattern.
Cool.
Thank you, Vijay. Yes, I was going to see Renata if you wanted to come in. Would you like to come in?
So this is Renata. I'm on the phone.
Yes. Yes, would you like to come in?
Yes. Here in Brazil, we have a lot of experience with restricted cash. And I think that the agenda decision that is suggested here may mislead the reader of the financial information, because most of the cases, we are not able to use this cash. So if we say that cash and cash equivalents, we are going to show a liquidity that's not real, and of course it's going to mislead the reader of the financial statement. So I wouldn't agree with the suggested wording. I think it should be requested by the statement that the restricted cash should be in a separated line, and the reasons why it's a restricted cash should be disclosed in the financials also.
Thank you, Renata. I'm going to come back on that point that you've raised and a couple of others in a moment. But first of all, can I let Paul in?
Yeah, thanks, Sue. Quick observation. I agree with what a number of others have said in terms of the analysis and the conclusions, and as Renata was saying, the importance of disclosures. IOSCO has, of course, in a number of times over the years, encouraged the board to look for opportunities for convergence, and in particular where we have a converged answer at the moment, to try to retain convergence. So I think it's useful to note that this question came up in the U.S. context about 5 years ago and landed in a spot very similar to where the committee is coalescing. So I think that is a very useful data point as part of the analysis. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. That's helpful to know. Andre.
Thank you, Sue. Yes, I'd say that I agree with the analysis and the conclusions regarding the presentation, the statement of cash flows, and even the maybe slightly modified understanding of the presentation, the balance sheet. I would say just that the importance of disclosure, I think, is quite high. And I, in discussing this and maybe even building on the point that Renata just made, I would say that I would maybe put more emphasis on paragraph 45 of IS 7. For me, paragraph 48, you know, I have a little bit of maybe hesitation about applying the words, you know, not available for use by the group to this cache, because for me, this cache is doing exactly what it's intended to do, and slightly different than a fact pattern where the cache is, you know, trapped and unable to be, you know, used, you know, in a country, for example, with foreign exchange restrictions or capital controls. So for me, those are different kind of in substance, you know, between being restricted use and being unavailable for use. So, but I still think that there are ways in which meaningful disclosure can be made. I just, for me, felt that the emphasis on 48 in paragraph 48 of IS 7 could maybe be, you know, slightly shifted in to maybe more focus on, you know, either IS 1 or paragraph 45 of IS 7.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Sue. I'll just make a brief comment to say that I completely agree with the staff's analysis. I mean, from my perspective, I just view that this restriction was a disclosure matter, and that this was just something that needs to be disclosed. Because going, I know to the point that John made, when I read the fact pattern, you know, the cache is available to use for obligations that would happen in the near term. So that's, you know, I would agree if it was something that we didn't think that what it was being earmarked for was going to be incurred into after 12 months or greater than 12 months, then I would agree that that's more about the non-current. But as the fact pattern is, I view that this is just really a disclosure matter. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, and potentially presentation.
Yes, presentation too.
To be pedantic, just to prove John.
Yeah.
John that I. Yeah. Okay, that's great. So can I think I know what the answer is going to be, but for completeness, can I get a show of hands on who supports the staff's recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan, please?
I'm seeing everyone on screen.
Thank you. And Renata? Renata, do you agree not to add it to the standard setting agenda?
Yes, I do agree.
Thank you, Renata. Okay, I'm going to hand over. Sorry. Oh, sorry, and Brian as well.
I'm possibly in a minority of one. Actually, I'm concerned about diversity on similar fact patterns.
It is still subject, though, to Brian. Only to say, I'm not suggesting you change your vote, but obviously we'll still talk about the exact wording on the tentative agenda decision.
No. I appreciate that, and I will have some drafting suggestions. Thank you.
Okay.
Before I head back to committee members who might have some extra comments on the agenda decision, I think that a couple of people said they were going to come back in, but just a couple of thoughts and maybe a question for Katrina and other members of the staff. So one thing that a few people emphasised, even though they agreed with the analysis in the paper, was how important it could be for an investor to understand that there are these restrictions on cash, even though the sort of label isn't changed, if you like. And we've highlighted in here, you know, the specific requirements which might be relevant both for disclosure and presentation. I wonder whether, in addition, the general requirement in IAS 1 to provide extra disclosure, if there's something that's, you know, really relevant to understanding, is also on point and should be added for completeness. Trina, Rhianna?
I think we...
An IS 1, isn't there a general disclosure about extra disclosure?
So I do think, and I know that... I can't remember. Somebody raised, Renata, I think it was raised about there can be, you know, liquidity information missing if there wasn't any disclosure here. So I do think the tentative agenda decision already has a reference to IFRS 7 on liquidity risk, which is important. But I think what you're suggesting, Sue, and at least I see no harm in just for belt and braces, also potentially adding a reference to that general requirement in IS 1 to provide something extra. to the extent it's relevant to an understanding.
Which would only kick in, obviously, if you applied all the other stuff and you haven't got there. But I think it's true that it could be really important for an investor not to miss it. And Rihanna?
Well, I think, yes, there is the IS1 disclosure, but, I mean, the cash is also covered by IFRS 7, which also has relevant disclosures for, you know, making sure users of the financial statements understands the risk that the entity is exposed to. So your cash and the restrictions that might be placed over that cash by something else could be covered by paragraph 14 or one of the other general disclosures in 7 as well.
And Jim made a point about people not necessarily understanding what a demand deposit is, and I think that's not an unfair comment. but I'm not sure that there's anything extra that we've got in the standards that we could extract to include in an agenda decision, given that we can't, you know, add to or change requirements.
Yeah, it is
a fair point, Jim, I think, but I'm not sure that I can think of anything off the top of my head that we could use. But with that, I just wanted to raise those points in case anybody wanted to comment on them. But does anybody have additional comments they wanted to make on the wording in the agenda decision? I think a couple of people said they'd come back. If you put in the chat box, I'll follow up with you. Brian?
Thank you, Sue. I have a couple of comments on drafting. Perhaps my overriding comment goes back to my original statement, fact pattern being one in which there is a demand deposit and then the restrictions we're talking about are in a separate contract with a third party, so not the deposit taker. So I would like that throughout the agenda decision, whenever there is a reference to the restrictions, i.e. the restrictions in the fact pattern, that be expanded to refer to these contractual restrictions that are with a third party or in a separate agreement. And I think that would be I hope it's not a controversial suggestion, but it would be a kind of pervasive suggestion as we go through. In respect of disclosures, I was very interested in the comments that you made actually about having a reference to IS1, perhaps IFRS 7, and I also tend to agree with Andre's comment that looking at the disclosures specifically in IS 7, paragraph 45 was perhaps more on point than paragraph 48. So I would be supportive of a section on disclosures that could, you know, that really talk at disclosure, because I think everybody that agrees that's important. But I think the most relevant references are probably paragraph 45 of IS 7 and the slightly more general references to IS 1 and IFRS 7. And then a very last one, just on presentation in the statement of financial position. The reference to having additional line items and presenting this balance separately, I guess I'd quite like to have the word disaggregating in there, just to be clear that what we're doing is we're dividing up, we're disaggregating the total of cash and cash equivalents, not presenting something in a separate line item because it's in any way for a different nature.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Karen?
Thanks. I was just reflecting on the various observations around being specific with the fact pattern. And I was wondering, when we look at the fact pattern, if a little bit of reorganizing might help address some of the concerns. Meaning that, you know, paragraph A could be the entity has a demand deposit with a bank. The terms and conditions, now I'm taking a wording from the beginning of B, The terms and conditions of that demand deposit do not prevent the entity from accessing the amounts held in it. That's A, so here's the demand deposit. And then B is the entity has a separate contractual obligation with a third party, right? So we're actually describing the demand deposit, the rights on the demand deposit, and then separately in B, being very clear, there's a separate contract with a third party and what the repercussions are if that contract is breached. And that way, I think it helps address the observations around the that this is separate and distinct from the demand deposit terms.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. Thank you.
I have one more. In the presentation section, well, actually, I think I have two comments in this one. One is the second paragraph in the part on presentation says, I think it's a bit of grammar, the way I'm reading it, is the first part of the sentence says, the committee concluded that this would be presented as cash and cash equivalents. And I'm wondering if we need to put a period at the end of that sentence, because some people could read the unless as being, if the circumstances at the back end of that sentence apply, then it's not cash and cash equivalents. And so I don't know if we want to break that conditionality up so that it can't be read, that it may in some circumstances not be cash and cash equivalents.
Yeah, I think, Karen, at least we can look at that. We could split that sentence. And I think it's a similar point to Brian's, that the way it's worded at the minute, I think you're both saying that it potentially could be read to say this is something different from cash and cash equivalents, because it's about saying it's cash and cash equivalents, but you might want to present it separately.
And then in the agenda decision, we don't bring in the commentary, granted that you know, I think people were commenting on, we don't direct the reader of this agenda decision that there's a separate presentation decision that they need to make around whether or not it's current or non-current. It's in the paper, but I don't think we draw their attention from a presentation perspective that they also should determine their expectation of when it will be settled and whether or not there's a current non-current decision to make there. Those were my comments.
Thank you, Karen. Karsten?
Yes, thank you. So I think, you know, what others have pointed out, I agree with that, especially the observation that, you know, core to our analysis and to our conclusion is, you know, the separation of the two arrangements. So therefore, I also think what Karen just suggested in terms of the description of the fact pattern would be a helpful drafting suggestion. I also wonder whether the wording of the agenda decision might be more helpful to constituents if, you know, if the words indicated more clearly that we get to this conclusion because in this fact pattern the restriction is with an external party rather than with the bank where the cash is deposited. I think the tentative agenda decision already suggests that. So therefore I would be comfortable also to support the tentative agenda decision as drafted. But I still think it might be an improvement to be more explicit or better explain this thinking. So I was wondering at the top of page 12, where, you know, the tentative agenda decision currently states that restrictions on use of a demand deposit do not result in the deposit no longer being cash unless such restrictions change the nature of the deposit in a way that it would no longer meet the definition of cash. And I think when, you know, when people read these words, they might wonder about, you know, when the restrictions would actually change the nature of the deposit such that it would no longer meet the definition of cash. So I guess one way to do this might be just to expand that paragraph slightly with the aim of making that paragraph easier to understand for our stakeholders. So, for example, we could say, you know, that this might be the case, or that this would be the case when the terms and conditions of a demand deposit prevent the entity from accessing the amounts held within it, or something like that, just to explain, you know, when that might be the case. I don't think it's absolutely necessary to do that, but I think it might be just helpful to better understand this paragraph.
Okay, thank you. Katrina, do you want to respond?
Yes.
The suggestions?
To the overall suggestions. Okay, the overall suggestions. Karsten, I'm maybe going to start with yours because at least my starting point is to think that we don't need to go there at the top of page 12, but let me explain that one first. So I think you're suggesting, yeah, that adding something that makes it clear when we think the, you know, restrictions do or do not, you know, change the nature. And I suppose at least I thought we had covered that in the context of this question submitted in the first section of the second paragraph on page 12, because we say in this fact pattern, you know, blah, 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 we think those restrictions don't change the nature, and that's because the entity can access those amounts on demand. So at least I think that's sort of said there, because I think your suggestion was just saying, say that in the reverse, to say when, you know, they do change the nature. So at least I think hopefully that point is covered, and it's covered specifically in the context of this submission, as opposed to starting to talk, you know, about maybe, you know, different fact patterns. I think if I run through then other suggestions, and I'll just start at the beginning of the tentative agenda decision, so page 11. I think in the fact pattern we had two suggestions. So one is Karen's to change the ordering. That it would kind of, and Karen, personally, what I like about what you suggested is to kind of state, first of all, the entity has a demand deposit. So I think that's a helpful piece to put in the fact pattern. So we change the order. So we make it clear the entity has a demand deposit. Then we talk about the terms and conditions of the demand deposit. And then we mention the contractual obligation. We had suggestion from Brian to make it clear that in this fact pattern, the contractual obligation is with a third party. Then if I flow through to the middle of page 12, presentation in the statement of financial position. Again, we've had two suggestions. One is in that second paragraph, just to kind of maybe split the sentence and possibly add disaggregating, just to make it clear that this item is always still part of cash and cash equivalents, even if you, you know, meet the requirements to present it separately. And then we did have a suggestion to add sort of the requirement from 66D that at least suggests the entity needs to consider whether it classifies this as current or non-current. I'll just make it clear, if we add that, clearly we're not adding any conclusion about this fact pattern because we haven't analysed it. It would simply be a reference to the requirement. Then I move through to disclosures. There was a small point just to pick up Goro's, where we'll take out the would at the very bottom of the page and we'll just say an entity also considers. I personally think it would be helpful to add a reference to IS1, and maybe in particular paragraph 31 of IS1 that talks about, by the way, when basically you might want to consider adding additional disclosure so that users can understand the impact, you know, of particular transactions, etc. And the last one that I had, that I don't know, I personally am perhaps on the fence on, so somebody else can take the call, is there were a suggestion by some that in the disclosure section we focus just on paragraph 45 of IS7, then we continue to include the reference to IFRS 7 requirements and we add the reference to paragraph 31 of IS1, and therefore we drop the reference to paragraph 48 of IS7. So that was the suggestion. We obviously as staff put it in here because we thought it may be relevant, but I'm on the fence then on whether we keep that or do not.
I think I'll take a, if it's okay with the committee, I think I'll take a, ask for a show of hands on the agenda decision with the adjustments as outlined by Katrina, but keeping in the reference to paragraph 48 of IAS 7, and let's and then to see what comments are raised about the application of that in this fact pattern, because I think it could be useful to have that additional information. But let me see if the committee agrees with that approach. I also asked the staff questions about the wording in paragraph 48 for what it's worth, but I'm actually interested to see what our stakeholders' comments would be. But having totally overstepped there. Could I get a show of hands in terms of whether the committee would support the tentative agenda decision with the adjustments that Petrina outlined, sorry, but keeping in the reference to paragraph 48?
I am seeing everyone except Andre on screen. So on screen, Andre's a no, everyone else is a yes.
And on the phones, Renata?
I agree with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Renata. And Brian?
I'm very supportive of the drafting suggestions and support the agenda decision on that basis.
Thank you. Okay, great. Okay, thank you very much. So we'll move on now to our last discussion. So agenda paper 6, cash received via electronic transfer. Going to hand over to Sam to tee up the paper. And for the new committee members, you might not know that we ask people to be particularly nice to our staff the first time they present to the committee. Not that you're not usually nice, but be particularly nice because this is Sam's first outing at the Interpretations Committee.